Welcome, Disability Law Show. We're back for another hour. Good to have you along for the ride. If you've contributed over the last week or two with your emails, you might hear it on this show in just a bit. If not, always keep sending them, and we get through as many as we can over the course of the hour every week. help@disabilityrights.ca. That's the email address. Phone number to reach James Fireman, the lawyer on staff here, always ready to go with the show. To reach James and his team, 1-855-821-5900. We'll give you a couple of other websites and contact information throughout the hour. They're stacking up already, buddy. The emails are coming in fast and furious. But we always start off with the week that was or case of the day. James, what do you got cooking this week, pal?
Well, a topic that has come up on our show quite a bit, particularly recently, is the focus of the LTD analysis. So I'm talking here about when you apply for your benefits, what the insurance company, and particularly what the policy, requires to be analyzed in order to determine whether you're entitled to benefits. The policy is going to say you're entitled to your benefits if you have a medical condition that's preventing you from being able to do your own occupation. That's in a nutshell what it says. But that does not mean that it requires you to have any particular diagnosis, or for that matter, a diagnosis at all. You may well be suffering from a medical condition that the doctors as yet are not able to determine what it is. That can happen if you haven't been referred to the right specialist yet, if the right testing hasn't happened, or it can simply happen because medical science has yet to be able to come up with a way to determine what your condition is. Here, think about long COVID. Long COVID is something that is widely accepted as a thing that is affecting many, many people. And yet we don't have any definitive test to be able to say that someone is suffering from long COVID. We can put the pieces together based particularly on a previous positive COVID test and by symptoms that occur at some point afterwards that fit with the profile of others that have suffered similarly. But there isn't a definitive test. There's no x-ray. There's no blood test that can show that you're suffering from a condition that is long COVID. And so you do not require a particular diagnosis. What you require is a medical condition that is restricting or limiting your function in such a way that you're not able to do your own occupation beyond 2 years, any occupation. That is what the analysis is supposed to be. And so there is an interesting case that I'm dealing with where this particular issue has come up. It's a pharmacist who has had low-grade OCD for a long time, obsessive compulsive disorder. And the way this showed up is in a checking behavior. So a checking behavior is when you need to double, sometimes triple check things. Think about making sure that your stove is off or that the door is locked. And so that's the way it can show up. And for him, it was something that for many years was there, but wasn't really having a huge impact. As a pharmacist, one of the primary functions, of course, is checking prescriptions, making sure that you have the right prescriptions, making sure that there isn't a drug interaction that you need to be aware of or an allergy, and making sure that you provided the correct dosage and the right number of pills. There's a lot of things to check as a pharmacist. And so when this first became an issue for my client, it was something that he was doing occasionally, and it was slowing him down, but not to the extent that it was a big issue with his employer. He was somewhat less productive than he had been, but still certainly capable of continuing to work. But this became a much bigger issue for him in COVID, particularly with the added pressure that was put on both himself and certainly all other people that were working through that. And it manifested as an exacerbation of his condition. It made things significantly worse to the point where he was checking everything 5, 6, 7 times. Wow. He was having difficulty concentrating. And that is debilitating, particularly for somebody who's working as a pharmacist. That may not be something that is an issue, even if it becomes more pronounced. That may not be something that's an issue for everybody. And it's, you know, not going to be an issue if it doesn't manifest, if it doesn't show up in all situations. But for a pharmacist who is obviously in what we refer to as a safety sensitive position, mm-hmm. that itself is a trigger for this condition. That was a very big issue for him. So I'm just throwing that out there because I think it's useful to help frame what we're looking at. Obsessive compulsive disorder, which is something that he had for many years, is not in and of itself necessarily going to be disabling. And it wasn't for him for a long period of time. It only became disabling when it got to the point where it impacted his ability to function in the workplace. And incidentally, it's worth noting that even when it got to that point, the assessment that was done on him still characterized his condition as a mild OCD, a mild obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, I'm not qualified to comment on whether that should be mild or more. It's frankly a little surprising to me that medically that would be deemed mild, but yeah, it's not my place to say whether it is or not.
Yep.
And that's the way that it was characterized. But mild or not, the impact on his ability to function in his job was so significant that he just wasn't able to do it productively anymore. And his employer didn't want to keep scheduling. Understandable because of that. So think about function, not diagnosis. Yes, in this case, he did have a diagnosis, but the diagnosis itself isn't particularly meaningful. What's meaningful is how that medical condition, diagnosed or not, is impacting on your ability to function.
It's a good opener, James, and it's, you know, it's often said it's how it affects the workplace is not the definition of whether it's severe, mild, or super severe. It doesn't matter. I can't work, and this is affecting me, and that's really the basis. With medical backing, that's all he really needed, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the last part that you just said with medical backing is important. And there's a distinction between having medical support and having a diagnosis. They're not the same thing. So you may have a condition that the doctors, your GP, the specialists your doctors have sent you to are not yet able to diagnose. But they may, your GP in particular, having seen you over a longer period of time and sent you to these specialists and been able to see you in person and be able to see what you've reported both to your GP as well as to your specialist, is in a position to say whether there is a medical condition and whether that is having an impact on your function, even if there's not a diagnosis. And as long as you have that medical support, as long as you have a doctor typically that is going to be able to say that you are medically disabled from working, even though there isn't yet a diagnosis, that is sufficient. You do need medical support, though. It's not enough to just say, okay, well, I don't feel well. I have a condition that is making me really, really tired, and my back hurts all the time, and I can't do anything, and so I'm not working, without then following up and getting medical support. If you haven't gone to your doctor, your GP in particular, and gotten support that you're not able to work, no insurance company is going to approve the claim, nor should they. Just going to your doctor doesn't guarantee that you're going to get that medical support, by the way. Your doctor may say, well, I don't think this is a particularly serious condition. You might just need a little bit of rest, and then I think you're going to be okay. If your doctor says that, whether they're right or not, you don't have medical support. And so it's not something that an insurance company is going to be required to pay benefits on. You do need the support of your doctor or your therapist or whoever's providing you with treatment, but it doesn't necessarily have to come in the form of a particular diagnosis.
Let's move on to Thomas's email here. First one of the show. Appreciate it, Thomas. Ahead of time, says, my partner Vincent has a lung disorder, but was denied his LTD claim earlier this year. He hired a lawyer to bring a claim against the insurance company, but the lawyer told him that he has to apply for a litigation loan to cover disbursements. This doesn't seem right to me. Is this normal? I'm not an expert in financial matters, and the loan documents are complicated, but from what I can tell, it looks like the interest rate is really high. Should I agree to this, or should he agree to this?
Hard no. No.
Yeah.
No. A litigation loan is not a normal thing for an LTD lawyer to request of their client. It really is not. So just for understanding here, litigation loans exist, or companies out there that will offer a loan either to a firm or to an individual in order to help pay for the cost of litigation. This happens a lot, particularly in personal injury cases that can drag on for several years.
Right.
And if the person isn't working, sometimes there may be no other way for the person to keep themselves afloat than to get a litigation loan. For long-term disability, this should really not be the case. And if it's ever used, it should absolutely just be a last resort. And I know we're not going to get any litigation loan companies as sponsors on this show, and that's fine. That's fine, because these litigation loan companies charge exorbitant interest rates, often more than 20%. And there's all kinds of hidden fees in there, administrative charges. And So you wind up paying such a huge amount that it becomes very difficult to resolve the case, because you know that when you resolve it, a huge chunk of it's just going to go to paying that litigation loan. And it's definitely not something that your lawyer should be pushing on you to pay for disbursements. Samfira Tamarkin, and frankly, most other firms I know of that are practicing in this field, when we take on a case, it's because we believe it's going to be successful. And because of that, we are prepared to take on those disbursements. And if your lawyer isn't prepared to do that, I'd look for another one. The disbursements are something that your lawyer absolutely should be covering for you.
And we covered it on that one for sure. Quick break, James. We'll get to more emails and questions. We'll go to My Disability Questions after that short break. In the meantime, the number to reach James, 1-855-821-5900, or email help@disabilityrights.ca. We'll continue more of the Disability Law Show coming right back. You bet. Disability Law Show, that's where you have landed. James Fireman is your guy at the firm, Samfira Tamarkin LLP. Reach out anytime, 1-855-821-5900. Might be a simple question or a chat with James. Won't cost you anything to pick up a phone or send that email, obviously, help@disabilityrights.ca. I did mention another website just going into the break called mydisabilityquestions.com. It's pretty self-explanatory. It's a website you open up, and you can ask James and the team your questions. Just type them into the question box there. You can even search it to see if your question or one similar has been asked previously, and you can use that answer. If not, if it's not fulfilling, then leave your own question. Again, mydisabilityquestions.com. Anonymous, for instance, this just says, can I leave the country if I'm on short-term disability or long-term disability? James, what do you think?
Yes, sure.
Done.
You can do whatever you want to. Whether that's going to have an impact on your long-term disability or short-term disability payments is a different question. But I want to be clear about something. Just because you're on short-term or long-term disability doesn't mean that you can't do something that you feel like you want to do. You can, you just have to be aware of what the consequences might be. And I say that because there are going to be situations where whether or not your insurance company approves of something shouldn't change your decision. So for example, if you have family that's living outside the country, and particularly a close family member who is ill, and you want to visit them, I would notify your insurer, but I wouldn't ask for permission. Unless you are in such a difficult financial position that any disruption in your benefits is going to cause you to, let's say, lose your house, then I suppose you do have to make sure that they're going to do the right thing. But in other situations, the reality is that insurance companies have to be reasonable in these situations. And so first you would want to know what the policy says. Most policies will allow you to travel even outside the country, at least for a limited amount of time. Sometimes it's just 2 weeks. Sometimes it can be a month. When you do that travel, you do need to make sure that you are able to continue with your treatment. And so you want to take steps to ensure that if you're getting any in-person treatment, that this can be continued either by Zoom with your present treatment provider or with an alternative treatment provider wherever you're going.
Right.
And that you have all medication in advance, and that your treatment provider agrees that it's reasonable and safe for you to travel. If all of those things are there and there's a very good reason for you to travel, then there shouldn't be an issue. Your insurance company should agree to do it, particularly if there is a reason that requires you to go, such as a sick family. On the other hand, you may just want to take a vacation. You may just want to take a couple weeks in the sun. there you want to really make sure that you're staying within what your policy says. Whether it's a 2-week or 1-month limit, you want to make sure that you're within that. You want to preload your insurer, tell them that you're planning to do this, tell them that you already have approval from your doctor and that you've already set up a plan to make sure that you're able to continue your treatment, you're able to continue your medication regime, whatever it is, you want to make sure that's there. But again, if this isn't because you need to go and it's because you want to, you're probably best advised to make sure you first get clearance from your insurance company. So that's a long way of saying, sure you can, but make sure you understand what the consequences might be before you do. And take a look at the policy and get that approval from your doctor.
Yeah, your last bit there is probably the most important. As long as you have the medical piece taken care of, because you don't want to go against your doctor's word, even though the insurance company says maybe go ahead, you're okay to do so. If they find out you went against your treating professional, then you might have a problem, yeah?
Yeah, 100%. If your doctor is saying you shouldn't go, then it's going to be a big problem for you. That's for sure. Your insurance company will see that and will use that as a justification to terminate benefits. Yeah. But the converse isn't necessarily true, which is to say, even if you do go and get approval from your doctor, that doesn't necessarily mean that your insurance company will accept that and be reasonable. I've seen situations where they don't, or situations where someone has decided that they did want to take a couple weeks and get some sun, and even where the doctor has said, yeah, that's a good idea, especially when we're dealing with people who have mental health issues, such as depression or anxiety. I frequently see doctors suggest that going to a nice warm environment will help them with their condition, even where the person has gotten approval and support from their doctor. I've seen insurance companies do things like say, oh, well, that's all well and good, but we're actually going to have you start this work hardening program over the same period of time, coincidentally, and therefore you can't go. All of a sudden they've decided, I've seen that happen. So you can't necessarily assume that just because you have medical support that the insurance company is going to say, yeah, that's okay. What do you do in that situation where you have medical support and your insurance company says, no, sorry, you still can't go? Well, this gets back to my first comment. You can do whatever you want to do. Your insurance company can't prevent you from doing it, but there may be consequences that you have to be aware of. If you have medical support, and better yet, if your medical providers, whether they're doctor or treatment provider, is saying that it would be beneficial to you, and your insurance company still says no, I would go, as long as you understand that your insurance company is probably going to cut off your benefits, understanding also that you will be in a very good position to then challenge. If you can afford to do it, then I would do it. And also keep in mind that if your insurance company is getting in the way of that, they're probably lining themselves up to cut you off in the near future anyway.
Right.
So whether it comes now or a month or two from now doesn't make the biggest difference in the world in most cases, especially if you have an ongoing valid claim that you can bring a lawsuit to recover on. So consider what the consequences might be and then make the best decision for yourself. And that may be to force the issue and deal with a termination of benefits a little sooner than you otherwise would have if the result is something that you prefer anyway. You need to go on that trip for whatever reason and the insurance company says no, it may still be worthwhile doing it, even knowing what the insurance company will.
All right, let's move on down to Margaret with that answer. An email says, I've been off work on stress leave for the past few months due to anxiety and depression. I was denied short-term disability benefits because the insurer said there wasn't enough evidence of a disabling condition. I've sent a report from my doctor and the disability form, so I have no idea what they want. I have no money coming in, and this is increasing my stress. To make matters worse, I was rear-ended last week and injured my neck and my back. My auto insurance is offering to pay for some therapy. Does this affect my disability claim? I'm so overwhelmed, and I could really use some help. Wow, James, what do you think?
A lot going on here. So first and foremost, you want to make sure that you're dealing with both the long-term disability as well as a motor vehicle accident together. So you want to make sure you're hiring a firm and a lawyer that's capable of handling both issues. And certainly that's something that myself and the other lawyers at my firm are more than capable of doing, dealing with both the complicated motor vehicle legislation in Ontario, as well as long-term disability. To answer first the specific question about whether or not the therapy will affect the disability, the auto insurance provider is offering therapy here, Margaret says. So no, it shouldn't affect the disability claim. It puts you in a much better position. So just to give this some context, whenever you suffer an injury in a motor vehicle accident in Ontario, regardless of who is at fault, even if it's a one-car collision that you cause on your own, you are still going to be entitled to some benefits. They're called statutory accident benefits, through your own auto insurer, or if you don't have insurance, through the insurance of the driver of one of the vehicles involved. Even if you're a pedestrian that's hit by a car, you're going to be entitled to this insurance, even if you don't have your own auto insurance policy. So you will be entitled to get some coverage for treatment for any medical conditions that arise from a motor vehicle collision. That's really important to understand. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with taking advantage of that potential treatment in terms of what that does for your long-term or short-term disability claim. In fact, it strengthens your claim in the sense that if you didn't take advantage of it, your insurance company for STD or LTD would say, well, if you were really injured, why didn't you take the treatment that was being offered through the automobile insurer? And that would be a valid question to ask. Yeah. If you're not getting reasonable treatment, the insurance company can say you're not required to pay ongoing benefits. And if you had this available to you after the car accident, then you really should be taking advantage of it. So first and foremost, absolutely, if the therapy is being offered by your auto insurer, take advantage of that. Now, I want to get back for a moment to the beginning of Margaret's question when she's talking about having been offered stress leave and anxiety and having sent in the report from her doctor as well as the disability forms, and the insurance company is still saying, no, there's not enough evidence of a disabling condition. So this is unfortunately an issue that comes up more frequently with mental health claims than it does with physical issues. And that's largely because there isn't objective testing that can definitively show that you have depression or anxiety. There's testing that can be done, but insurance companies can always say there's no objective proof and then say, okay, well, we're not paying your benefits. Here's the kicker, though. That doesn't matter. The law doesn't require you to have objective proof of a disability. There's nothing in your policy that says that you need to have objective proof of a disability or objective proof that you have a particular diagnosis. As we've already talked about on this particular episode, you don't need a particular diagnosis. And for mental health claims, you certainly don't need to have any objective evidence that shows that you're suffering from the condition. If you have treating doctors and therapists that are saying that you are suffering from a medical condition that is preventing you from being able to do your job, then you're entitled to the benefits. And if your insurance company isn't agreeing with that, they're wrong. They're wrong. It's as simple as that. Yeah. And if that's the situation you find yourself in, then you have every right and certainly a very good case to challenge what the insurance company is saying, to challenge their position. So if you're in that situation, if you're listening at home and your insurance company has denied your claim, even though your doctor, your therapist has said that you can't work and you know that you're not able to continue doing your job because of your medical condition, then you have a claim and is something that we should get started on right away because you're entitled to those benefits. Even if your insurance company is saying otherwise, this is something that you are paying for. Even if it's something that your employer is covering the premiums for, that is part of your compensation package. That's part of what your compensation is. So you are paying for it, even if it's indirectly, and you are entitled to those benefits. And if they're not paying them and your doctors are saying you're not able to work, then you're entitled to those benefits. Give us a call and let's get the claim started.
Margaret, thank you so much for reaching out with that that great question. You can follow up with the phone calls. James mentioned that number, 1-855-821-5900. That goes for you as well. If you're listening, keep that number, 1-855-821-5900. Email help@disabilityrights.ca. And we're going to flip back to mydisabilityquestions.com for a question after a short break, which we'll get into and back from momentarily. So stick with us right here on the Disability Law Show. Disability Law Show, we're back for a few more minutes here. Reach out even beyond the hour. You're always encouraged to do so because you feel the content of the show. We love getting your emails, and we read them out on air. And everybody can glean something from it, learn something at least. And that is help@disabilityrights.ca. Phone number for James and his team, James Fireman at the firm, 1-855-821-5900. Okay, here we go. The question, as I mentioned before, the break from mydisabilityquestions.com. Is late diagnosis of ADHD a disability? And also, I have been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. Can I apply for long-term disability? So take them piece by piece, I guess, James.
Well, so I saw both of these come in through mydisabilityquestions.com, and it makes sense to deal with them at the same time. Mm-hmm. This has actually been on point for what we're talking about throughout this show, which is the difference between a diagnosis and your ability to function. And so the first question is about a late diagnosis of ADHD. The second is a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. And so the answer is maybe those diagnoses are sufficient to support a long-term disability claim, and maybe not. Just having the diagnosis doesn't mean that you're not able to work. There are certainly many, many people with a diagnosis of ADHD that is sufficiently controlled, that is allowing them to be able to function and function very well in their own occupation. The question isn't a binary question of whether or not you have a diagnosis of ADHD, of fibromyalgia, of cancer. Whatever the diagnosis is, in almost all cases, it exists on a continuum where there are very mild cases and very severe cases. And even if there is language that says mild or moderate or severe, that in and of itself doesn't necessarily answer the question. As I've already mentioned in an earlier segment on this particular show, the analysis is on function, not on the diagnosis. And so the question is, does the ADHD manifest in such a way that your function at work is sufficiently limited that you can't do your job? Or is your fibromyalgia manifesting in a way that's preventing your function, that is functionally impacting you in a way that's preventing you from doing your job? That's what you have to look at. What is your ability to function as a result of the condition? Whatever you want to call it, whether it's ADHD, fibromyalgia, or anything else, the issue is, how is that impacting you while you're at your job? And if it's impacting you in a way that's preventing you from being able to do the substantial portion of your job, then you're disabled from work. And if it isn't, then you're not. So the answer to that question is maybe. What you need is support from your doctor or treatment provider that says, not only are you suffering from a medical condition or even this particular medical condition, but that that condition is preventing you from being able to do your job. If you have that support from your doctor, then yeah, you should be entitled to disability benefits. And if you don't, it's going to be real difficult, and you're almost certainly going to be denied.
Let's move on to, what do we got here? Mario. Let's go down to Mario. It's an email. Back to email, James. Says, guys have been getting disability insurance for a bit over a year because of a back injury that will probably need surgery. It's been an issue for 15 years, but has gotten progressively worse. My insurer is now pressuring me to apply for CPP disability benefits, but from what I gather, this won't actually get me any more money, even if I am approved. Can I just ignore them?
You can't just ignore them, unfortunately. So you're likely right, Mario, that even if you're approved for CPP disability, it probably won't change how much you're getting. So let's put this into context here. CPP disability, it's a federal program where if you are sufficiently disabled, then you're entitled to get a monthly disability benefit. It maxes out at around $1,500 per month. It goes up a little bit each year. The test for CPP disability is more difficult than the test for LTD. The test for CPP disability is a severe and prolonged disability. So if you are approved for CPP disability, you should also be approved for LTD. The reverse is not necessarily true. There are certainly situations where you might qualify as disabled under an LTD policy, but not CPP disability. But what happens if you are in receipt of both? If you get, if you're approved for long-term disability and approved for CPP disability, is in most LTD policies, there'll be a provision that will allow your LTD insurer to offset whatever you get from CPP disability against that monthly LTD benefit. So let's say you're getting the full $1,500 from CPP disability, and your usual LTD benefit would be $4,000 a month. Now, your LTD provider is only required to pay you $2,500 a month. So the net amount to you is the same. But actually, it might even be less because the CPP disability benefit is taxable and many LTD policies are not taxable. And so if you have a non-taxable policy, but you're approved for CPP disability, you're actually worse off, even though the net amount or the gross amount of money is going to be the same. Now, if you are applying for CPP disability, there is also the federal disability tax credit. It's unfortunately a different department because it's federal government. But if you are also approved for the disability tax credit, that should cover the tax consequences of CPP disability and at least put you in the same position you would have been had you not been approved or had there not been an offset. So all of this may be raising the question, why on earth would I bother going through all of this if it's going to put me in the same or worse position? Fair question. The answer is because if you don't, most LTD policies have a provision that says that the insurance company is entitled to estimate what you would have gotten if you had applied and then take that as an offset. So if you don't apply, you're going to be less money for sure. If you apply and you're approved, you may be the same, you may be slightly worse off, but if you get the disability tax credit, you're the same. If you're denied CPP disability, you're in the same position. Mm-hmm. So all things told, you are far better off applying. It's also worth mentioning that if you are approved for CPP disability, as I mentioned before, it's a tougher test.
Yes.
And so if you're approved for that, it puts your insurance company in a far more difficult position in terms of either denying your claim or, once approved, terminating your benefits. If the federal government is saying that you still qualify for CPP disability, which is widely understood to be a more difficult test than the LTD.
Fantastic answer, brother. As always, we got one more short break, and then we're getting into our last few minutes of the show. So it'll give you some time to maybe get your email along to us. If we don't get to it, we'll look at it for a future show, help@disabilityrights.ca. And beyond the radio show, always reach out to James or remember the crew, 1-855-821-5900. We'll continue back to My Disability Questions, that website, for another question after a short break. Hang in there. All right, welcome back. Disability Law Show. James Fireman is your guy. San Firu to Market LLP. Reach out to James anytime. It could be for something complex and bothering or a simple question for that matter. 1-855-821-5900. help@disabilityrights.ca. Or the website built for you to ask questions anonymously and get answered from a member of their team, mydisabilityquestions.com. In that regard, James, here we go. Can I take disability leave from my labor-intensive job, but still work my second job, which is a different field of work? I'm suffering from spine, knee, hip, and feet problems and can't handle the job until I receive treatment. Okay, what do you think?
So this is a really interesting situation, and I'm going to assume that the person who wrote this was already doing two different jobs at the time they became disabled, one sedentary and one physical, the labor-intensive job that they're now disabled from. Assuming that to be the case, they should be able to continue in their second job. Typically speaking, when you look at most standard long-term disability policies, they will not take as an offset income that is earned from a position that was already generating income before that is different than the job that you're disabled from. So oftentimes this would not apply. You would be able to continue in that position. And I've had several clients that were in a very similar situation where they had two different jobs and were able to continue one and not the other. It doesn't necessarily mean that you wouldn't be able to continue working in your other job, but make sure of that before and make your decision on that basis. It may well be that you still continue working at the second job, even if it disqualifies you from the disability benefits of your first, because you just need to make sure that you have that income coming in if that income is greater than what your disability benefits. But make sure you're aware of what that is before you make the decision. Now, this is very different from someone in this situation who has a labor-intensive job and becomes disabled and then gets an opportunity to work in a sedentary position that wouldn't aggravate their disability. In that scenario, if you were to start a new job while you are in the disability process, let's say you're approved for your disability benefits on the basis of disability from your physical job, and you've been getting benefits for 5-6 months, let's say, and then somebody says, hey, would you be able to, or would you be interested in this job? All you got to do is sit behind a desk, answer the phone, pay you good money. If that were to come up, that would almost certainly be an offset against any benefits you were entitled to, and more than likely would zero out any benefits you would be getting. You don't have to go and do some other occupation in the first 2 years that you're entitled to LTD benefits, even if you're capable of doing it. That's not a requirement. That comes up after the two-year mark. So you want to be very clear on that distinction. If it's something that you were doing before, usually you're going to be able to continue doing it as long as you're not disabled from it. But if it's something new, you typically can't. Now, if there is an opportunity that arises for you to do something on a part-time basis or a limited basis, there may be an opportunity for you to do that even within the context of your ongoing LTD benefits, but it's something that you would have to, first of all, make your insurer aware of and coordinate with. You know, you could tell them that you have an opportunity to, you know, do something very limited, let's say some online position that requires a few hours a week and that you're making a few hundred dollars a week on. That may be something that your insurer would approve of and say that's fine. And as long as the money that you're getting is accounted for in their benefit formula, possibly as an offset, they would be okay with. Or it may be something where it's a bigger opportunity and your insurer is prepared to allow you to do that as part of rehabilitation. And so if that is the case, and you have to be prepared for the fact that at the end of that, they may well take the position that they don't have to pay your benefits anymore. But at the very least, if you think it's a good opportunity, there is a way to do that in coordination with your insurer so that if it doesn't work out, you haven't done anything to disqualify you from benefits. Now, once you go down that path, even if it doesn't work out, practical reality is most insurers are probably going to take the position that you're able to do it anyway. But if that were to happen, if you attempted to go back in some other position with the insurer's approval and it didn't work out, you weren't able to do it for whatever reason, and the insurer didn't reinstate your benefits, then you would almost certainly have a very good basis to challenge that decision. And that would be something where you give us a call and we would be able to start your claim and then get you those benefits by bringing a lawsuit.
Yeah, it's interesting. The you know, the offset piece you're talking about, you know, from money from the second job that's existing wouldn't affect their. For me, I was more of a concern that they wouldn't let him go on claim because he's still working. Might be a sedentary job, but how dare you try to claim disability? You're still going to work every day in job number two. I thought that would be the bigger hurdle.
So in most disability policies, it does allow you to continue in something that you were already doing, as long as that isn't something that is going to suggest that you're also capable of doing the occupation you're covered for. Right. So let's be a little bit specific here. Let's say you are a
roofer.
A roofer, sure. That's the typical physical job. And that you also have a side job as a telemarketer. Yep. So if you're able to go do the job as a telemarketer, that says nothing about your ability to be a roofer.
Gotcha.
Nothing at all. If, on the other hand, you're less physical job is still some, let's say you drive a van around and deliver boxes for some company on the side.
Yeah.
Well, there's a physical element to that.
Yes.
And, you know, you're lifting boxes, you're driving around for extended periods of time. It's not the same thing as roofing, not even close, but there is a physical element to it, and that does create an argument that you might be capable of going back to your other job. Whether that argument is valid is an entirely different question. But that is a different thing. That is something where the insurer may take that position that you are not disabled as a result of being able to do this other job. If they are, one's very physical, one's completely sedentary, as in that first example, it shouldn't be a problem. But again, as with everything, take a look at what the policy says. Make sure before you do, make sure that you're able to continue the job you had before. And if you're not sure, give us a call and we can help you sort through that. All we need to do is take a quick look at the policy.
And with that, we are just about out of time. I want to thank you for not only this week, but every week providing some great content and questions for the show. You do that a couple different ways. That is through email, firstly, help@disabilityrights.ca. That other website, which we've used a couple times so far today, mydisabilityquestions.com. That's free and anonymous, by the way, and searchable, which is a nice algorithm, so you can see if your questions come up before. Save you a bit of time, right? And then failing all that, you'll always have the phone call to reach out to James and the team as well. 1-855-821-5900. Again, 1-855-821-5900. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening and tuning in and contributing. We'll catch you next time on the Disability Law Show.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.